At the dawn of humanity as we know it, Homo sapiens was limited to a relatively small part of the world, compared to where we would later settle. We covered a stretch of East Africa down to the southern tip of the continent. Human-like species, Neanderthals and Denisovans, roamed what we now know as Europe and Asia, respectively. But they had broken off from the main stem of humanity hundreds of thousands of years ago. From the cradle of humanity in East Africa, everyone knows where some people went, north, settling what's now the Middle East, and then fighting and other effing Neanderthals in Europe. The Neanderthals died out, but also gave some of their DNA to most people in populations settled afterward. If you're East Asian, white, Native American, Pacific Islander, or Aboriginal Australian, chances are you're 1 to 5% Neanderthal. Homo sapiens spread from there to Asia, interbreeding with the Denisovans, and finally across now submerged Ice Age land bridges to the Americas and Australia. They moved fast enough that they kept elements of their language and culture as they journeyed. Today's Navajo and Apache languages in the American Southwest are pretty closely related to indigenous languages in Siberia, all the way across the Bering Sea land bridge. In some way, the settling of Easter Island during the first millennium AD, possibly the last landmass settled by pre-modern humanity, was the endpoint of the great out-of-Africa trek that all non-African humans can trace their origin back to. But at the same time that some humans were on their way north to lands unknown, a different group stayed in Africa and headed west. They made their way from the East African savanna to the rainforests of what's now the Congo and the Central African Republic. For millennia, they were isolated, and to this day constitute one of the earliest divergences from the main stem of Homo sapiens. For reasons not fully understood even today, they became shorter with each passing generation, with adult men eventually standing an average of 4'11". At some point in their past, they interbred with Bantu people, who are taller, practice agriculture, and migrated to the area much later. This is where the original people of the Central African rainforest get their mostly Bantu-derived languages, but they cut themselves off from the Bantu several thousand years ago for reasons we will probably never know. As it is, these people's culture may be the closest on Earth to that of the first humans. At an unknown point in their past, music became essential to their society. Their music is mostly based around wordless vocals and can include several different wordless melodies being sung at once. It's a level of complexity that wasn't reached by European classical music until the 14th century. And so the people of the rainforest sang their way through the millennia. Thousands of years on, thousands of miles north, the Greek scholar Aristotle wrote a passage in his text, History of Animals, about cranes, the birds. Common European cranes migrate from Poland and Scandinavia down to Egypt and Ethiopia every winter, flying over Greece on their migratory route. Where the cranes were going each year was one of the many common questions Aristotle investigated. Aristotle wrote that the cranes, quote, migrate to the marshlands south of Egypt, where the Nile has its source. Correct so far, but he went on. And it is here, by the way, that they are said to fight with the pygmies. And their story is not fabulous, as in it's not fake. There is, in reality, a race of dwarfish men, and the horses are little in proportion, and the men live in caves underground. End quote. Okay, Aristotle, I believe you. Aristotle was not the first or only ancient Greek figure to write about cranes fighting little people called pygmies. In fact, It was fairly common knowledge in the upper echelons of ancient Greek society. Where are the cranes migrating to every year? Why, to Africa, of course, to fight their mortal enemies, the pygmies. Pliny the Elder disagreed with Aristotle's claim that the crane-fighting pygmies live in caves, but did not dispute the pygmies' existence. How the notion of pygmies battling cranes entered the Greek imagination is unknown. But the Greeks could have known about actual African pygmy people. They had trade with ancient Egypt, and throughout almost all the existence of ancient Egypt, little people were worshipped, both little people and people who are little. The Egyptian god of family and the household, Bes, was always depicted as a dwarf. Having a little person in the family was seen as a blessing, and little people regularly served in high-ranking roles in the pharaoh's court. Most of these were ordinary Egyptians with dwarfism, but a particular kind of little people, said to have come from lands far to the south, were in particularly high demand as entertainers, who would perform unusual songs and dances at special events. Many historians believe these people were African pygmies. Either way, no Greek had probably ever seen an actual pygmy. The implied size of the Greek crane-fighting pygmies varies depending on the teller. Some stories suggest they're short but believable-sized humans, like the real African pygmies. In others, they're a few inches tall at most. Naturally, because the Greek stories about pygmies are so ridiculous, by the time the Renaissance rolled around, stories of congenitally small people in Africa were treated as fantasy, probably just a garbled retelling of the Egyptian cult of little people. It wasn't until the 19th century, when some European colonists, reporting on what they'd heard from Bantu people in Central Africa, suggested that unusually short people really might exist deep in the African rainforest. Naturally, these well-read gentlemen explorers suggested that they should be called pygmies, but they also said that it was impossible. It was probably a myth. There was no way there were uncontacted tribes of little people in the jungle. That's fairy tale stuff. It took until 1865 for an explorer from the West to confirm the existence of the pygmies, Paul du Chaillu, from the French island colony of Réunion, after a 2-year expedition in the Congo. Du Chaillu was himself 1/4 black, a fact that he hid from his contemporaries in the scientific world, and that may explain why, despite being a European anthropologist in 19th century Africa, he never supported the scientific racism of the period. He was also the first European to document the existence of gorillas. So, in all, Du Chaillu was a pretty cool guy. But he opened Pandora's box for the pygmy. The pygmies knew about white people before the white people knew about the pygmies. Even if they likewise dismissed stories of such strange-looking people as a myth, it was clear by the 1860s that an evil wind was sweeping through their homeland. The Bantu people, who the pygmies had feuded with since time immemorial, had new weapons, practiced new religions, and spoke new languages now. Stories spread of frighteningly powerful people, getting closer to the rainforest every day, pillaging, enslaving, and re-educating everyone in their path. Initially, it wasn't clear to the pygmies that this would be a bad thing. They were already treated as second-class citizens by the Bantu, who saw the pygmies as primitive and not fully human. Sometimes, the Bantu enslaved them. To some in the pygmy villages, it seemed like the Bantu were getting their rightful comeuppance. In the words of Qui-Gon Jinn, there's always a bigger fish. And the decline of the pygmies during colonialism was slow and hardly ever driven by direct contact with white people. A few of them were taken to zoos in Europe and America and exhibited as primitive pre-human specimens, but it's hard to say if that was a worse fate than being enslaved by the now gun-toting Bantu. Today, with most of the countries where they live embroiled in civil war, and no real rule of law to speak of. Many pygmies are still effectively slaves, sometimes forced to work in logging camps, cutting down the very rainforest where they live. But for a few lucky ones, their way of life, their hunting practices, their ceremonies, their music, it all lives on, though not in the same way it did before colonialism. Now, spin the globe again. Go another few thousand miles north. It's a cold night in Amsterdam, early 1980s. Louis Sarno, originally from northern New Jersey, is listening to the radio. He's in his late 20s, with a partially completed doctorate in comparative literature that he doesn't ever plan to do anything with. He is working odd jobs in the Netherlands after moving there to marry his Dutch girlfriend. His one real passion in life is classical music, and even that has gone neglected for a few years, after he had to leave his record collection behind in New Jersey when he left. One night, he turns on the radio, and in his own words, rediscovers music. Writing about it years later, he describes it as a melody that rose and fell in endless repetition, as hypnotic as waves breaking on a shore. It divided his life into before and after. He spent months trying to track down the origin of the song, finally discovering that it was from the Pygmies. Not fully understanding what had come over him, Sarno bought a plane ticket to the Central African Republic, and became one of the few outsiders to ever truly integrate into Pygmy society. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Central African Republic is one of the least developed places in the world. On the Inequality-Adjusted Human Development Index, a ranking of countries based on life expectancy, education, wealth, and economic redistribution, the Central African Republic sits at number 156 out of 156. It has the world's lowest GDP per capita, the fourth lowest life expectancy, and has been in an intermittent civil war since 2004, although it wasn't exactly stable before that, either. Most developed countries recommend citizens not to go there under any circumstances. And yet, in late 1985, Louis Sarno arrived in Bangui, the capital of the Central African Republic, with 30 blank cassette tapes in tow, intent on spending 3 months in the rainforest recording pygmy music. Sources aren't clear on whether he had ever been to Africa at all before this. In his 1993 memoir, Song from the Forest, he says it was his first ever visit to the continent, but a few other profiles on him mention a trip to South Sudan in either 1983 or 84, which was a first unsuccessful attempt to get into the jungles of Central Africa. Either way, by the time he landed in Bangui, Sarno had done his homework. He had been in contact with the anthropologist Colin Turnbull, who before Sarno was one of the few Westerners to have lived in a pygmy community, and Sarno initially wanted to seek out the same tribe that Turnbull had lived with, the Mbuti, in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. But Sarno decided that the Mbuti were too mainstream for him. They had been documented too much by Western anthropologists. Their area was too easy for Westerners to reach, so their culture was probably too polluted by outside influences, Sarno thought. Sarno set his sights on the Ba Benjale of the Central African Republic, who he thought were the most undisturbed tribe of pygmies, with the most complicated music. Most people Sarno met in Bangui were intrigued but skeptical. Nobody really tried to prevent him from trying to find and record the Ba Benjale, but a lot of people said that they themselves had never met a pygmy, and his chances weren't going to be any better. After 2 days of rattling and bumping through the forests and scrublands on a series of overcrowded buses, Sarno arrived in the logging town of Bomanjombo. Here, everyone had told him, he would be certain to meet pygmies. Whether they would entertain his designs of living with them for 3 months was another matter. Word got around fast that a strange white person had shown up in Bomanjombo, looking to find some Ba Benjale and record their music. A non-pygmy local named Christian declared himself Sarno's guide as soon as he stepped off the bus, and took him to a nearby Ba Benjale camp. It was not exactly the pristine pre-agricultural settlement Sarno expected. The pygmies were dressed in old sports jerseys and shorts that had ended up in Africa after being thrown away in the global north. The camp's apparent chief said that Sarno could stay, but only if he regularly furnished the community with cigarettes and alcohol, to which he reluctantly agreed. He was given a hut to stay in. Before his arrival, it had been used as a dump. Sarno had accomplished his goal of being accepted into a pygmy village with remarkable speed, but it still felt like something was missing. If these purported hunter-gatherers were doing any hunting or gathering, he wasn't privy to it. Most of the food they ate seemed to be bought in Bomanjombo. Peanut butter, fried dough, tapioca. The closest thing to meat Sarno ate during his first days there were boiled tadpoles, which he says tasted like mud. Every now and then, he would see men set off hunting with their spears and machetes, but it seemed as if all their hunts came back empty-handed. There wasn't a lot of music. They all spoke French, which Sarno was fluent in as well. He had only learned one phrase in the Ba Benjale language. Beke Ndaku. It means, give me a cigarette. Sarno was beginning to worry that in the globalized world, you can never truly leave home. And it seemed the Ba Benjale were beginning to recognize that Sarno felt this way, which complicated things a lot more. He didn't want to record the Ba Benjale performing for him because they wanted to please him. If he wanted that, he'd have just listened to some previous ethnomusicologist's recording of pygmy music. Simcha Arom, the other person who had made detailed recordings of pygmy music up to this point, had no interest in integrating himself into their society. He had asked them to sing for him, and they did. Sarno didn't like this approach. Sarno wanted to record the Ba Benjale as they were, singing for nobody but themselves. He just wanted to be a fly on the wall. And he feared that the historical door might have closed for that. As Sarno's savings ran out, buying cigarettes, moonshine, and weed for the Ba Benjale, he began to despair that the whole project he'd devoted his life to for the last few years had been a bust. Several times, people promised him that if he gave them more money and more cigarettes, he would get to hear real pygmy music. But every time they played music for him, it wasn't what he'd expected. It wasn't what he'd heard on the radio all those years ago. On the night Sarno resolved to leave, a party that was promised to be the big one, the opportunity to hear the music he'd been waiting for at last, devolved into a drunken brawl. He stayed, since he had nowhere else to go. A few days on, Sarno was invited to go fishing, which was uneventful, but it was the first time anyone had asked him to come along on a trip like that. That night, he was finally rewarded. Out of nowhere, a group of children, as young as 4, began tapping on some drums, and others danced. One by one, the entire village began to join in, with the women singing a soft, cyclical, sort of yodel-like theme. Only the men didn't sing, as a protest against Sarno's new policy of no longer bringing them alcohol. Never mind, this was the music Sarno had come so far to hear. This was the spontaneous song of the forest. Leaves rustling and animal noises were incorporated into the song, and at one point, a strange, thrashing, haystack-like entity burst out of the bushes and spun like a top through the camp. This was a Mukundi, a forest spirit, the Bob Angele said. Of course there was a person under it, and everybody knew it. But that was one of those things that everyone keeps secret from everyone else, even though everybody knows the truth. It didn't matter that there was a person under it. It was still a forest spirit. The Mukundi were a deep secret of the Bob Angele, and by being introduced to them, Sarno was finally being accepted as one of them. From then on, Sarno's social status rose. He was allowed to have meat. Sure enough, as he expected, those hunts weren't coming back with nothing. Now people were singing, drumming, and playing the gidal, which is sort of like a harp, all over the place, all the time. It looked to him as if the first few weeks had been something of a village-wide initiation rite to test just how serious Sarno was about recording the Bob Angele. If he really wants to hear our day-to-day music, they seem to be saying, he needs to show that he deserves it. Before then, the Bob Angele had called Sarno patron, a term for a white person common across Central Africa, which Sarno understandably saw as, well, patronizing. Now, he was known as Monsieur Louis. He had made it. Although Sarno's finances weren't in great shape, he brought coffee to the village and began offering it to the Bob Angele, who would come and sit around a fire in the evening outside Sarno's hut. He began to learn their language, and more about their culture. There was a lot of leisure time among the Bob Angele. On the one hand, this wasn't the anarcho-primitivist, original, affluent society someone like the Unabomber may have dreamt of. Life expectancy among the Bob Angele was, and still is, 40 years, and many people didn't live to see their first birthday. Horrifying diseases Sarno had never heard of were rampant. At one point, Sarno was shocked to find that flies had burrowed into the soles of his feet and laid eggs inside them, which was a common enough occurrence there that Bob Angele children had learned to walk in unusual ways so as not to step on the holes that flies had dug. But they had this going for them. They didn't work much. They didn't need to. In fact, they didn't really have a lot of social obligations at all. Some men would go hunting every morning, and it would take a few hours to get what they felt was enough. But if you didn't feel like joining them, you didn't have to. There were always enough people who would, so everyone would get to eat. The rest of the day was taken up with naps, conversations, and music. The chiefs had no real administrative power. You could go to them and ask for their advice on something, but on the rare occasion that they tried to order people around, nobody would really listen, and no one would need to. They were more Dear Abby than Dear Leader. Now Sarno wasn't a cigarette machine, or an ordeal to be tolerated. He was a VIP, and he was treated as one. On slow hunting days, when most of the Bob Angele had to eat caterpillars, what meat they were able to get was given to Sarno. This wasn't quite what he wanted either, and he demanded to be allowed to eat caterpillars, because he wanted to be accepted as one of them and treated normally. They were a bit confused by his insistence that he wanted to eat lower quality food, but they let him eat caterpillars like everyone else. To further his connection, Sarno announced one night around his campfire that he would pay someone, in cigarettes of course, to teach him the Bob Angele language. He was getting along fine with them in French, but they only spoke French around him. A man named Mouma offered to teach him. Sarno took out one of his notebooks to write things down, and I think I'm just going to have to quote Sarno's entire description of his first lesson. "Bampungungwa," Mouma said. "Bampungungwa?" I repeated. "Eh-heh," he replied. "Write it down." He watched carefully as I wrote, a contemplative smile transforming his face, miraculously, into an expression of innocent friendliness. When I finished, he asked me to read it aloud. "Bampungungwa," I read. Mouma smiled with satisfaction. "But what does it mean," I asked, "in French?" "Never mind what it means in French," he replied impatiently. "You already know French." I knew there was no point in arguing against his logic. He resumed the lesson. "Inderti inemotiti," he said, and instructed me to write it down. When I had amassed half a page of incomprehensible scribblings, which threw me into a kind of despair, Mouma had me read it all aloud. "Voila!" he cried triumphantly. When I finished, "That is the language of the pygmies!" I paid him his 2 cigarettes, and he departed a happy man. Even with this unorthodox teaching style, Sarno found himself picking up the language of the Babenjale, which they called Yaka. He became closer friends with many of the villagers, eventually being allowed to go hunting with them. Being much bigger than anyone else in the village, he was both an asset and an albatross, depending on what needed to be done. He could tackle a duiker, a kind of antelope that was their main source of meat, awfully well, but he wasn't exactly light on his feet, nor easy to hide. On one of Sarno's last days there, an old woman passed away, and he became one of the first Westerners to witness a pygmy funeral, which include hours of unique vocal music called alelo, lasting from the discovery of the death to the burial of the body. Out of respect, Sarno didn't record it. And then, Sarno had to go home. He'd accomplished more than he'd dreamt of during his 3 months with the pygmies, but now his visa was up, he needed new batteries in his recording equipment, and it was time to go back. He was missed by everyone in the village, none of whom had ever met a white person who showed so much interest in getting to know them. But it was another 2 years before he was able to return to the Central African Republic. He found that his life wasn't quite as directionless as it had once been back in the West. He wasn't a nobody anymore. He was the holder of some of the most complete recordings of pygmy music ever made, which got him plenty of attention in some niche circles. The Pitt Rivers Museum at Oxford gave Sarno a grant to go back and make more recordings. Walter Sloss, the Dutch DJ and ethnomusicologist who had played the song that changed Sarno's life, offered him a solar battery recharger so he could keep his equipment going indefinitely. And in New York, Sarno was contacted by none other than Brian Eno, one of the most legendary music producers of all time. Eno was creating a multimedia art piece on the rainforest for the New York Winter Festival, and he wanted recordings from Sarno. Sarno said he would be back in 6 months with the music. And so, Sarno returned to the place he had never really stopped thinking of as his home. Now something of a celebrity among 2 groups, pygmies and ethnomusicologists. His Babenjale village, Amopolo, had been growing in the time he'd been away, integrating with a few other pygmy camps in the area. Meanwhile, Bomanjombo had declined after the local sawmill, which was run by Yugoslavians, of all people, had closed. The area had become all the more remote. But at the same time, the government of the Central African Republic became more intent on quote-unquote civilizing the pygmies, which they referred to as the citizens. The mayor of Bomanjombo boasted to Sarno that he had required the pygmies to replace their traditional huts with bamboo shacks, which, he said, were far better. Next, he was going to try to make them organize their village along straight lines, instead of having all the shacks haphazardly piled next to each other. the Babenjale were regularly being harassed by the police. At the same time, though, the Babenjale were also becoming more interested in the fruits of the outside world. Sarno had told them that he had made money selling their recordings, so, understandably, they wanted compensation. They understood that Sarno had been broke the previous time he visited, and now he wasn't broke anymore, largely because of their songs. So they could ask him for whatever they wanted within reason, and he would be compelled to give it to them. He promised machetes for a few men in the village, which led to nearly everyone complaining that they needed a machete too, so he ordered a whole bunch of machetes. After several months, Sarno had to go to Bangui to cash some checks, to which the village reacted as if he was Santa Claus. Everyone requested something. Underwear, jewelry, flip-flops, pots and pans, a knife, even a guitar. This one was requested not by a member of the Babenjale, but by a Bilo, which was the pygmy's name for non-pygmy Africans. Sarno had to decline that one, but he got him a machete to make up for it. Sarno had also begun to administer eye drops for the rampant conjunctivitis in Amapolo, which was the beginning of his longest-lasting role in the village, the medicine man. Never mind that it was Western medicine he administered. He wasn't like a foreign doctor. He was one of them. Not long afterward, the Babenjale moved on. They only lived in Amapolo for part of the year. At the end of the dry season, they retreated deeper into the forest and set up camp along a river, in a place called Mombongo. Sarno, of course, went with them. As they set up camp, thousands of bees swarmed up out of the bushes and crawled all over them, and Sarno discovered for the first time that he is deathly allergic to bee stings. One of his friends pulled the stinger out in the nick of time, but for the remainder of their time in Mombongo, Sarno was mostly active at night, when the bees weren't out. Nevertheless, he described those days as the happiest time of his life. He kept on recording the nightly music, but not necessarily to send it back to the West, just to remember these moments for himself. The Babenjale began to ask Sarno if he had any loved ones back in America. By then, he didn't. Not really. He had divorced his Dutch first wife before heading off to Africa. Things were already going south with them, so to speak, long before Sarno went south. He had no children. He had some friends from college, notably including the art house filmmaker Jim Jarmusch, who had befriended Sarno before either of them were famous in their respective niches. But his closest friends were in Amapolo. He didn't have anyone back in America or Europe who he was closer to than he was to the Babenjale. So, the Babenjale began to tease him, "You should marry a Babenjale woman then." And Sarno, who was already developing a crush on a girl in the village, began to wonder, why shouldn't he? A lot of Sarno's book, Song from the Forest, is devoted to Sarno trying to get with Mbali, the girl he had a crush on. She agreed to marry him early on, but the last 100 pages or so of the book are about Sarno trying to figure out whether they're together or not. They have a wedding ceremony, but nothing changes after that. Eventually, everyone tells Sarno that Mbali doesn't like him anymore, and he should have seen that all along. For a long time, they exist as a couple in the elementary school playground sense, where everyone says the two of them are together, but they'd never hang out together and hardly ever even talk. Around them, life goes on. The Babenjale return to Amapolo after one of them is accidentally shot by a Bilo attempting to save them from a gorilla. Months later, a few of them get arrested by the deputy mayor of Bomanjombo, who is accusing them of causing the local sawmill to close using black magic. This kind of allegation is a pretty common one for Bilo to levy against pygmies. They're released after Muwuma, the man who tried to teach Sarno the Yaka language, goes to the site of the sawmill and digs up an onion under the watchful eyes of the authorities, exonerating the entire pygmy community. The onion is seen as proof of a curse, and removing it, therefore, removes the curse. Why that exonerates them is never explained to Sarno. Brian Eno finds out where Sarno is somehow and sends a telegram to Bowman Jumbo asking for the new recordings. Back when they had met in New York, Sarno had promised to get them to him by a month ago, but forgot about it as he integrated further and further into the lives of the Bob Angeli. The remainder of Song from the Forest plays out like a rom-com, one of those early 2000s rom-coms where the male main character is kind of a bad person who doesn't deserve to get with the manic pixie dream girl, but you root for him against your better judgment because he's just that dopey. Sarno threatens to leave the community if Mbali doesn't confess her love to him. Initially, it's an empty threat, but out of nowhere, Brian Eno wires him some money. So he flies all the way back to New York. All the while, Sarno feels like a fish out of water and can't wait to get back to the Bob Angeli. 3 weeks after telling them he was leaving forever, Sarno arrives back in Amapolo, feeling bad for himself. Like hell would Mbali ever want him. A deep depression sets in which Sarno realizes he would always be a weird bohemian from New Jersey. He was just exploiting the Bob Angeli for fame and fortune, and now he was demanding to marry one of them? If he'd just read about himself, he'd have hated that person. But then, the mood lifted. It was festival season in Amapolo. And what that meant was a visit from Ijengi, the most powerful of the forest spirits. For days, someone, their identity was a closely guarded secret, would dress up as Ijengi, covering themselves in thick palm fronds, and dance almost constantly as everyone in the village sang and drummed. Sometimes, Ijengi would pull off magic tricks, where they would appear to collapse into a pile of straw. Someone would go up and lift up the pile to show that there was nobody under it, like a magician making the audience sure that there was nothing in his hat before he pulled a rabbit out of it. And then, all of a sudden, the pile would reconstitute itself into Ijengi dancing once again. As magical as the Ijengi festival felt, it was also marked by conflict between the Bob Angeli and the Bilo, who often showed up to watch the festivities and brought alcohol and drugs with them. Sarno began to believe Amapolo was too close to the Bilo towns, and he and Adamo, the village chief of Amapolo at the time, began to plan for a new, more permanent settlement deeper in the forest. Malaria began going around Amapolo, and while Sarno tried to treat everyone he could with quinine, this further reinforced his desire to move the village somewhere else. And with the sawmill closed, the Bilo in Bowman Jumbo had become more demanding of the Bob Angeli, with the mayor often sending police and forcing the pygmies to collect palm fronds for them in the forest for no compensation. One by one, family by family, the Bob Angeli of Amapolo began to move to a new site plotted out by Sarno and Adamo. The move breathed new life into the community, and at long last, Mbali admitted that she really had loved Sarno all along. They married for real as soon as they arrived in the new village, which they named Yandumbe, after a nearby stream. Mbali was the first of three Bob Angeli women Sarno would be married to for a while. As far as I know, there was never too much strife in his relationships. He and his then-wife would just decide they'd been together long enough, and they'd move on to other people. Some sources claim that he fathered pygmy children, but I don't think he had any biological children. He did adopt a lot of kids, though, a role he'd implicitly signed up to fill when he began to treat malaria and other illnesses among the Bob Angeli. Anyone left orphaned by disease was adopted by Sarno. By the 2010s, he had a wife named Agati and three kids, including a son named Samdi, which means Saturday in French, who he had adopted when malaria killed his biological parents as a toddler. Samdi nearly died too, and Sarno promised him that if he recovered, someday he would take Samdi to New York. In 2011, when Samdi was 13, he made good on that promise, a journey depicted in a documentary also called Song from the Forest. In that documentary, it felt like the big city scared Sarno more than it scared Samdi. Sarno was palpably out of his element the whole way, while Samdi went around fascinated, begging his dad to buy him Western toys and, at one point, a gun. Sarno wisely refused, and he was glad to get back home to Yandume, while Samdi felt like the trip was over too soon. In 2013, disaster struck the Central African Republic. The Seleka, a militia formed by the country's Muslim minority, overthrew the country's president, provoking thousands of members of the Christian majority to take up arms as a paramilitary called the Anti-Balaka. They slaughtered Muslims by the thousands, forcing most of the Muslims in the country to become refugees. The Seleka held on to control in a few places, including the part of the country where Sarno lived. Whether Christian or Muslim, the Belo saw Sarno's presence in their country as a mystery waiting to be solved. They understood why all the other white people in the country were there. There were some who supervised mines or sawmills. There were some who were journalists, documenting either the conflict or the wildlife. Sometimes clueless diplomats arrived, looking to negotiate a resolution to the war. Everyone who came to the Central African Republic from the West had a clear motive for doing so. Except, it seemed, for Sarno. What was he doing living with the Pygmies? He can't just like the Pygmies. Nobody likes the Pygmies. A rumor began going around among both the Christian and Muslim militias that Sarno had integrated himself into the Babenjale in order to discover the location of red mercury reserves deep in the jungle. Red mercury is a mythical substance that can supposedly be used to make nuclear weapons, probably invented as Soviet disinformation in the 1980s. Ever since, many a developing world dictator has tried to get their hands on a source of red mercury. The Seleka were coming for Sarno, and they wanted to find out where the mercury was, by any means necessary. Sarno fled across the border into the Republic of the Congo, then finally to New Jersey, where he was worried sick about what would happen to his friends and family. The Babenjale fled deeper into the forest, while the Seleka arrived in Yandume, destroying Sarno's collection of recordings and smashing the last authentic Mbio flute in the world, which its last player had bequeathed to Sarno when he died. In the neighboring national park, a Sudanese faction of the Seleka killed 26 elephants for their tusks. Heartbreakingly, Sarno wrote in a plea for more attention to the Central African conflict, quote, "I'll let you in on a secret. When those Sudanese poachers came to Tsanga Bay and slaughtered 26 elephants with automatic weapons, I was glad. I really was, because I knew that now there would be a vigorous international response." But Sarno had to lead that response. Some in the West called him the unofficial foreign minister of the Central African Pygmies, although he always rejected that title and said he was there for their music and their culture. After 6 months as a refugee in New Jersey, he returned to the Central African Republic against everybody's advice inside and outside the country. Almost immediately upon arriving home, a Seleka colonel showed up and robbed Sarno of everything he had. His money, his recording equipment, his notebooks, even the malaria medicine he was bringing for the Babenjale. Sarno persevered. He went to the Seleka's main base and announced that he wanted to speak to the colonel. He demanded that the Pygmies should be left alone. In exchange, he promised to give the colonel the last valuable thing he had that the colonel hadn't stolen. His watch. The colonel said, "I will die with this watch on my arm." The red mercury rumor was dropped. Out of caution, Sarno and the Babenjale stayed at their forest refuge for the next several months. Sarno survived nearly every tropical disease there was. He had battled malaria, leprosy, and hepatitis B, which finally caused so much damage to his liver that he had to return to his hated New Jersey for medical treatment. He spent his last few months certain that he was about to recover, just as he had all the previous times he'd come down with something exotic, and before long he'd get to head back home and say hello to his family. Louis Sarno died of cirrhosis in April 2017, at age 62, in Cliffside Park, New Jersey. What he left was the most complete collection of pygmy music in the world, a shaky piece in a tiny corner of the Central African Republic, otherwise still war-ravaged to this day, and a fascinating, unbelievable life story, told in largely similar strokes around pygmy campfires and Western ethnomusicology classrooms. But for as unique a person as Sarno was, his story is disarmingly familiar. It's not too far off from some mawkish movie like Dances with Wolves, or even James Cameron's Avatar. There is, in fact, a mawkish movie based on Sarno's life, called Oka, made with Sarno's approval in 2011 and filmed in Yandome. Sarno worried that his presence was bringing too much Western influence to the Babenjale. Or was he the opposite? There's this saying in America that immigrants are more American than the Americans themselves. You can apply that to any other country. It's common for immigrants, you know, people who have strived and struggled to get to a new country, to be more patriotic about that country than the native-born people. Sarno was more obsessed with pygmy culture than any pygmy was. Sarno wasn't trying to westernize the Babenjale, he was trying to de-westernize them. Remember, it was Sarno who spearheaded the relocation of the Babenjale village to a spot further away from the Bilo village. When he clashed with his fellow Babenjale, it was usually over them becoming less interested in their own traditions and being interested in Western culture. I think the conversation where Samdi begs his stepdad to buy him Western toys is very illustrative. These are your traditions, he would say. You need to preserve them. To which some of the Babenjale would respond, why? Change comes to everyone. But for all that, he was universally accepted by the Babenjale as one of them. He was happier with them than he had ever been in New Jersey or the Netherlands. It's rare for someone to receive such a clear calling in life, and rarer still, to go out there and fulfill it, let alone when it's that outrageous. In the hut in Yandumbe, where Sarno worked for years, recording his friends' songs, dispensing medicine when people needed it, he wrote a two-line poem on the ceiling. Here I lie, in house of earth, waiting for an upper berth. That's birth with an E, as in a bunk bed. An upper berth, as in a position higher than this one, a higher calling. Sarno hoped, someday, he would die under those words, surrounded by his found family, but it wasn't to be. We can all agree, though, that he found that upper berth. He was always working for something greater than him. Most people have wild, unrealistic dreams, and most people never achieve them. Louis Sarno,